I have to introduce a piece of jargon to you. Well, you may well have heard it. It's being used quite often as we hear news about Syria. The spillover effect. The spillover effect of the exodus of Syrian civilians escaping the war, fleeing into neighbouring countries. No one wants to be part of the spill, to be displaced from homes, but most families have absolutely no choice. And the raw figures are disturbing to say the least. Let me run these past you. 2.1 million refugees fleeing Syria have sought protection in neighbouring countries. 22,000 pregnant Syrian women in Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon and Turkey. 390,000 Syrian refugees transported by the International Organization for Migration, IOM, from border camps to camps in Iraq, Jordan and Turkey since the onset of the crisis. And on Monday, even more startling figures surfaced about the extent of the Syrian refugee crisis. AFP reported that the UN has predicted that 4 million more Syrians will be forced to flee their homes in 2014 as the conflict there escalates. 2 million will leave Syria as refugees, the other 2.25 million will be displaced within Syria. Now, the movement of refugees in the Middle East has the potential to destabilize governments and of course, even redraw the map of the whole region. And to discuss what's happening now and prospects for the future, we welcome back to the program Nadine Shahadi. Nadine is with the Middle East program at Chatham House in London and was formerly director of the Centre for Lebanese Studies at Oxford. Nadine, welcome back. Before we get on to the refugee issue, a quick comment on the chemical weapons issue. The US Secretary of State Kerry yesterday actually praised Assad allowing inspectors to start destroying weapons. Has the chemical weapons issue been a useful distraction for Assad?
Yes, absolutely. I called it that these chemical weapons have poisoned the mind rather than the population. It's poisoned the mind of the West and diverted attention from what's really happening in Syria. And this, in a way, is a repeat of what happened in Iraq in 1991. Saddam Hussein was destroying his chemical weapons, and at the same time, he massacred in 1 month probably as much as Bashar al-Assad did in one whole year. And the world only paid attention to the chemical weapons rather than what he was doing internally and did not intervene, especially after they had encouraged the Iraqi population to rise. So we are seeing the same phenomenon happening. The international community does not want or cannot envisage Syria without Assad. They cannot look beyond him, and they are keen to keep him in power while at the same time he feels he has a license to kill.
And the massacres and the destruction continue with impunity. The regime is triumphantly declaring victory over its opponents and gleefully celebrating the impotence of the United States.
Yes, absolutely. That's how it is seen. And there is another side effect of this, which is that it promotes the impression that the United States and the West engages its enemies and lets down their friends. And that's a dangerous idea to be circulating around U.S. allies in the region, especially in the Gulf states, where it would encourage more radical elements.
Okay, let's look at the work you did on the Palestinian refugee problem, or rather, how that informs your view of the way international policymakers approach the refugee issue. You're not overly impressed.
Well, one is not impressed if one looks at the humanitarian angle and only at the humanitarian side, which is the predominant view of what's happening in Syria. There's a very important political element in this. If one looks at the Palestinian refugees, for example, the Palestinian refugees The problem started in 1948, which is fairly soon after the countries surrounding Palestine or Israel had gained independence. So it's accompanied them throughout their history up till now, and it's affected the development of their history in a way. Their history was shaped by that problem, and what we're seeing now is what is called the spillover from Syria is also not a purely humanitarian issue. It will have an impact on the politics of the countries and on their future, of course.
Nadeem, various international bodies have announced plans for a new appeal for extra aid. It seems that it's approaching what's past a tip-over point, where it's simply beyond the ability of outside agencies and NGOs to really ameliorate very much.
Well, it's even beyond their imagination. I was present in meetings in Beirut when the international community, the UN agencies, the representatives of the donors and government agencies were speaking with great alarm about the potential of having 50,000 Syrian refugees in Lebanon at the end, by mid-2012. That was at the end of 2011. We are now at 20 times more than that. So any plan they would have done collapsed.
So let me get this right. Lebanon, I understand, is about 750,000 Syrian refugees.
Yes.
And, of course, is also host to many Palestinian refugees. So Lebanon will need a lot of help to deal with this.
Yes. Now, the figure of 750,000 is the official UNHCR registered figure. The real figure varies between 1 million and 1.5 million.
Wow.
And a population that's about 4.5 million. So one every four people in Lebanon is a Syrian refugee. And to make things more complicated, Lebanon itself is divided about what's happening in Syria. Now, if you want to put this in a kind of scale that's understandable to people in the West or in other places, in England, there was a rumor of a few thousand people coming from Bulgaria to work in the UK because of some EU regulations, and that almost brought the UK Independence Party into power in the country. It strengthened its position. It's the right wing organization in England, which was very weak, but a small incident like that strengthens it.
Well, as you're well aware,
Australia.
Yeah, we're in a panic over very modest numbers of so-called boat people. It's absolutely grim. Okay, food, shelter, critical in any refugee crisis. Are the Syrian refugees at a particular disadvantage because the countries they're fleeing to simply don't have the facilities?
Well, yes, it puts pressure on resources, on institutions, on hospitals, on schools, and it puts pressure on governments, especially governments that have, in a way, decided to take responsibility in the sense of providing services or trying to organize such an inflow, like Jordan. The camp in Jordan is Atmi camp is a huge camp, and any crisis there, any lack of provision of, say, water or sanitation, could cause immense health hazards to the refugees and to the country. That's on top of the political impact on the resident population, on their relations with each other. When you try to regulate the flow of refugees, you're bound to get into trouble. In a way, Lebanon has been able to cope with it because it's totally unregulated. So a refugee knows where he can go, where there's an enabling environment, if you like, or where he's welcome. And they can feel when, either politically or socially, they need to move away somewhere else. And they go to areas where they know people would welcome them. And so the impact is felt much less than one would expect, even though it is quite a serious impact.
You're hearing Nadim, who's with the Middle East program at Chatham House in London, formerly director of the Centre for Lebanese Studies at Oxford. Nadim, last week, a boat carrying 500 migrants from Africa sank off the coast of the Italian island of Lampedusa. In the latest UN refugee report, it's reported that Syrian refugees are going to Egypt so they can use that country as a base to get to Europe. It seems improbable that Egypt in its current state would be a popular place for refugees from anywhere.
Well, Egypt is a country of about 85 or 90 million, and 100,000 refugees that will go to Egypt will not have that much of an impact. And these are largely middle class people with some money who can afford to travel and who can afford the transaction costs or are qualified enough to go to Egypt to apply for immigration outside Egypt. So it's a different type of refugee than the ones that cross the border with only their flip-flops and their family after having lost members of the family and lost their homes and not knowing where to go in other neighboring countries.
Nadim, as you've emphasized, you can't divorce the question of refugees from the geopolitics of the Middle East. Those politics must make finding any solution pretty difficult.
Well, it depends how one defines the problem. I think what's happening in Syria is very simple to understand. There's a regime that's been there for 47 years, and people are fed up with it. We get fed up with our politicians after a couple of years. I think Washington is much more complicated and Brussels is much more complicated. The factors that have prevented the world from intervening in Syria to stop the massacre are more complicated than what's happening in Syria.
Mm. The appalling situation cries out for international action, yet a military response or the continued supply of arms risks igniting a regional conflagration, which would certainly lead to many more deaths and even more widespread suffering.
Yes, that was the argument in 2011 when we had 10,000 dead. Now we are way over 100,000 dead, and everything we feared would come from an intervention or even a clear policy has happened without that intervention. And I think the lack of policy rather than the lack of intervention is the problem. The lack of clarity on part of the West, which is heavily affected by internal politics, by the experience of Iraq, of Afghanistan, of Libya, of former interventions. And there's a lot of internal politics in there.
And of course the debate on whether to intervene in Syria is dominated by the Iraq experience. One of the worst case scenarios would see a repetition of policy towards Iraq between 91 and 2003 before the invasion.
That's right. And my view is that it's the policy towards Iraq in that period, between 91 and 2003, that created the problems that we saw after 2003. So the lesson is not that the removal of a dictator makes the country fall apart and the dictator represents stability, so he or she must be kept in place and removing them is a mistake. The lesson is that what the dictator does in order to cling to power, in order to remain the devil you know, is what destroys the country. And what you see after his removal is the consequence of that. And in Iraq, it's very obvious.
Before you came on, I was talking to Bruce Shapiro about the shutdown and the fiscal cliff. Obama's got his hands full, to say the least. He's probably quite happy to have the distraction of chemical weapons. It takes the heat off him as well.
Yes, and we will definitely pay the price for that. The Obama administration has, in a way, identified itself or created for itself a political identity which can be summarized in one sentence. We are not the Bush administration. And the Bush administration does intervention and regime change. We do engagement and dialogue. And unfortunately for the Syrians, the main characters in the Obama administration chose Bashar al-Assad before 2011 to illustrate that engagement was a good thing and that you could do deals with even unpalatable regimes and promote stability. So they were stuck into that narrative. If they call for intervention regime change now, they would be almost saying GW was right and we were wrong all along. And that's a very difficult thing to do in politics.
Decidedly so. Nadeem, I thank you very much. It's good to have you back.
Thank you.
And my guest has been Nadeem Shahadi, who's with the Middle East Program at Chatham House in London, formerly Director of the Center for Lebanese Studies at Oxford University. And now a dramatic change of theme, of mood, after a little bit of music. I'm going to talk to Anthony Grayling about his musings on friendship, friendships of all sorts. And I'm looking forward to this enormously. This is Ellie Nell on RN.